Hello, listeners. This is a special crossover episode with the Wanted Files podcast covering the life, death, and mysteries of Marilyn Monroe. In this episode, we cover everything you need to know about Marilyn's life and death and some theories surrounding her death. I do want to let you know, though, that I will be doing a deeper dive into Marilyn's life at some point down the road, where I will get really into some details of her life and really allow her legacy to shine. For now, enjoy today's episode, and please check out The Wanted Files with A.C. Roberts for more stories of unsolved mysteries.
Welcome to another special crossover of The Wanted Files
and Stars of the Golden Age.
Two shows, two different perspectives, one woman who became a legend.
I will take you through the life, the stardom, and the legacy of Marilyn Monroe, an icon whose light still shines bright more than 60 years after her death.
And I'll walk you through the night she died, the investigation that followed, and the theories that turned her final hours into one of Hollywood's greatest mysteries.
This is the story of Marilyn Monroe. The iconic sex symbol we all know as Marilyn Monroe was born as Norma Jean Mortensen in Los Angeles, California on June 1, 1926, into a less than ideal life. Her mother, Gladys, was twice divorced and didn't have custody of her oldest two children. She was separated from her second husband, Martin Mortensen, when she became pregnant with little Norma Jean. So, although he is listed as the father on her birth certificate, it is something that has been highly debated. Many biographers believe a man named Charles Stanley Gifford was Norma Jean's biological father, Gladys's boss at RKO Studios, where she worked as a film negative cutter. Neither of the men would be present in Norma Jean's life. Gladys was in no position to raise her baby properly, and she knew that. She willingly handed Norma Jean over to Albert and Ida Bolander, and they became her foster parents, giving her a good childhood in Hawthorne, California. Gladys lived with them for a short time as well, and even after she returned to the city, she made sure to visit her daughter on the weekends occasionally, and sometimes bring her to LA for a weekend. On a few occasions, Gladys showed up unannounced and tried to take her daughter, clearly in a very scary mental state. When Norma Jean was 7 years old, Gladys succeeded in taking her daughter back. But she would have been so much better off staying in the safe haven that the Bolanders had provided for her. This was the point in Norma Jean's life when all evidence of love, consistency, and safety would vanish forever. Norma went from a peaceful, idyllic childhood in the suburbs to a hectic world of chaos in a small home that she shared with her mother and another family. Just 6 months after the move, after being torn away from the only safety and love she had ever known, Norma Jean would lose her mother. Gladys had serious mental health issues, and she experienced a severe break in January of 1934. She was committed to the Metropolitan State Hospital and diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. Instead of going back to the caring arms of Albert and Ida Bolander, Norma Jean became a ward of the state. She was still just 7 years old. Since she had been residing in a home with another family when her mother became incapacitated, George and Maud Atkinson and their daughter, she was initially permitted to stay with them. It is believed that she was sexually abused during this time. From there, she was shuffled around between several other homes until she was finally placed in an orphanage in September of 1935, when she was 9 years old. She felt abandoned and unloved. One of her previous guardians, her mother's friend Grace Goddard, took her back from the orphanage just after Norma Jean turned 11 years old. But she and her husband only kept her for a few months. From there, she was shuffled around between homes of more strangers again. It was a sad, scary, lonely life. The one thing that provided an escape for Norma Jean was going to the movies. Movies were therapy for her, an escape from her reality. Anything that would move on screen, she said. She loved them all, but her favorites were Jean Harlow and Clark Gable. The final home Norma Jean had been bounced back into was the Goddards again. But when Doc Goddard's job was moving them across the country, they were abandoning Norma once again. But they had a great solution. Norma had just turned 16. They would convince their 21-year-old neighbor to marry her. There, problem solved. Norma Jean was his problem now. Norma Jean had just turned 16 when she married 21-year-old James Doherty on June 19, 1942. It was a marriage of convenience. It was not based on love. James enlisted in the Merchant Marines the year after they were married, and the couple moved to Catalina Island, where he would be stationed. He was shipped out to the Pacific the following year and would be gone for 2 years, leaving Norma abandoned once again. During his absence, she lived with James' parents and worked at an aviation company. It was at this job where she met photographer David Conover in late 1944. He had been sent to the factory to photograph female workers during wartime. He was drawn immediately to the beauty and magnetism of Norma Jean Doherty and asked her to model for him. This opened up the idea of a whole new world for her, and a way out of the marriage that brought her no joy. In August of 1945, 19-year-old Norma Jean moved out of her in-laws' home, got her own place, and signed a contract with a modeling agency. And this was the pivotal point where lost little Norma Jean began the grand transformation into one of the sexiest, most iconic women in history, Marilyn Monroe. The sweet, beautiful girl next door with the long, brown, curly hair was soon the agency's most popular model and was appearing in many magazines and advertisements. And she was hardworking. She was willing to go the extra mile and put in the long hours that were sometimes required of her. She was very enthusiastic about this new chapter of her life. Her life finally had meaning. She finally had a purpose. Someone finally needed her. The agency knew Norma Jean was something special, and they introduced her to an acting agency in the summer of 1946. Daryl F. Zanuck of 20th Century Fox took a chance on the 20-year-old beauty. She had zero acting experience, but her beauty drew him in. Norma Jean Doherty signed a contract with 20th Century Fox in August of 1946. And in September of 1946, she divorced her husband and changed her name to Marilyn Monroe. A new name, a new image, a new life. Marilyn's hardworking drive paid off as she put her all into acting lessons, singing lessons, and dancing lessons at Fox. She put in the extra time to observe the entire process of filmmaking so she could understand completely what was expected of her and how to best deliver it. Unfortunately, she was dropped after 1 year. Harry Cohn took her on at Columbia Pictures, hoping to make her the next Rita Hayworth. But they also dropped her after a year. In between these professional heartbreaks, Marilyn returned to modeling and did some of the very first television commercials. Marilyn Monroe was a great networker in her early career. And this paid off big time when she met Vice President of the William Morris Agency, Johnny Hyde. Johnny Hyde was enraptured by Marilyn Monroe. He even left his wife because of his love and infatuation for Marilyn. He was a very influential man. He was also 30 years older than Marilyn. I don't know what she felt for him. Maybe she loved him. Maybe he was more of an avenue to get through the difficult maze of Hollywood. Someone who could help her push through all of the blockades. But through him, she got more film parts, including a role in the insanely successful All About Eve back at 20th Century Fox and John Huston's The Asphalt Jungle, both in 1950. The icon herself, Betty Davis, said of Marilyn Monroe's performance in All About Eve, quote, "Definitely, no question, I knew she was going to make it. She was a very ambitious girl and knew what she wanted and was very serious about it. I thought she had talent," end quote. And John Huston described her work as unique and extraordinary. "She had no technique," he said. "It was all truth. It was only Marilyn." Johnny Hyde had paved the way for Marilyn Monroe. And then he died. He died on December 18th, 1950, at 55 years old. Marilyn's performances and their receptions in these two highly successful films in 1950 made Daryl Zanuck second-guess his decision to not renew her contract a few years back. She was signed under contract with 20th Century Fox again, this time a long-term contract. She would stay with the studio for the rest of her life. Marilyn Monroe was suddenly a star. She had made it. In fact, she was on the fast track to superstardom. Marilyn was stunningly beautiful. You couldn't not look at her. She had sex appeal that could be sensed miles away. But she was also sweet and kind and compassionate and so very lovable. She was gracious and gentle and vulnerable. She was very vulnerable. She was beloved by men and women. Everyone who met her seemed to love her. Magnetic is the best word I can think of to describe her. She was so magnetic. But deep down, when it came to just loving herself, she had really low self-worth and self-respect. She didn't love herself, and she didn't understand how anyone else could love her. She was constantly surrounded by people, but she always felt alone. She was the little girl who had been constantly abandoned, trapped in a movie star's body. In 1952, Marilyn met famed former New York Yankees baseball star, Joe DiMaggio. The two dated for 2 years and were married on January 14, 1954. Marilyn was 27 years old. But the marriage quickly proved to be riddled with jealousy, control, and lots of arguments. Marilyn was looking for a safe haven, a home. And that's not what she found in Joe DiMaggio. She filed for divorce just 9 months into the marriage. It was during her short marriage to Joe DiMaggio when the most iconic images of Marilyn Monroe ever produced would take place. Marilyn in the white dress standing over the subway grate. This was a scene from Billy Wilder's film, The 7-Year Itch. The famous scene was shot on Lexington Avenue and 52nd Street in New York City on September 15, 1954, at around 2 a.m. A crowd of thousands, mostly men, watched as Hollywood history was made, many of them having just strolled out of nearby taverns at bar close. Joe DiMaggio was there with what Billy Wilder described as, quote, "a look of death on his face." The two were divorced the next month. Marilyn Monroe had become stuck very quickly in the sexy, dumb blonde type roles. She was very well received in these roles, but she had dreams and aspirations of being a more dramatic actress. She wanted to be taken seriously. She wanted people to see her talents before her looks. Marilyn was very serious about accomplishing this goal. She studied at the prestigious Actors Studio in New York and even formed her own production company in 1955, Marilyn Monroe Productions. Under her production company, two films were produced, Bus Stop and The Prince and the Showgirl. The company folded in 1957 when she and her business partner, Milton Green, cut ties. It is speculated that her husband at the time, Arthur Miller, had something to do with the ending of her production company as well. Marilyn had married esteemed playwright Arthur Miller on June 29, 1956. On the back of one of their wedding photos, Marilyn had written a simple but prophetic, "Hope, hope, hope." She yearned for love and safety, and she hoped so badly that this was it for her. But it wasn't. Shortly after they were married, Marilyn found some notes that belonged to Arthur. Notes he didn't intend for his wife to see. In these notes, he said many degrading and hurtful things about Marilyn. Among them, he said she was a disappointment, and he said she was a whore. He wrote that she was an out-of-control child woman with endless emotional demands. He wrote that she was a menace and that she was hampering his creativity as a writer. This wasn't love, and this wasn't safety. Marilyn held on, and she wanted to build a family with Arthur Miller. She held on to that hope. She wanted babies. She wanted the white picket fence. She held on so tightly to that hope. But the hope was crushed. She experienced three miscarriages during her marriage to Arthur Miller, and the relationship deteriorated to the point where it had fizzled out completely. They divorced in early 1961. This was a harsh emotional blow to Marilyn. That lack of self-worth and self-love was felt at new heights. She felt unlovable. She felt like nobody could ever appreciate her for who she was under the hair and makeup and curves. She had been taking pills for a while by this point, but she began to turn to them for emotional survival a little heavier. She took uppers and then she took downers. She relied heavily on sleeping pills to overcome her debilitating insomnia. It was a very dangerous course she was on, and it severely affected her work. She was constantly late to the set, sometimes not showing up at all, and her mental health was visibly circling in a rapid downward spiral. Her relationship with 20th Century Fox had become very rocky, and her contract had been teetering on the edge for some time. She was not well. Marilyn was a forever lost little girl. That lost little girl who never really had a family, never had a home. Nobody ever loved her enough to give her the stability and safety and love every child deserves and needs to thrive. So when Marilyn began seeing Dr. Ralph Greenson, he saw these things as the root to most of her psychological obstacles. And he took a very unique and unorthodox approach to treating her. He welcomed her into his family. He gave Marilyn the family that she had been deprived of. Dr. Greenson, his wife, and his two children became Marilyn's family. And they all loved her. Marilyn and Dr. Greenson's daughter Joan became close, and they talked about your typical girl stuff, including men. During one conversation in the last year of her life, Marilyn confided in Joan that she was seeing someone very important and she was very smitten over him. He was so important, though, that she couldn't tell Joan his name. She would just call him the General. At the time, Robert F. Kennedy was the Attorney General of the United States. On February 10, 1961, just after the end of her marriage to Arthur Miller, Marilyn was admitted by her doctor to the Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic in New York, where she stayed for a horrifying 4 days. It was a mental institution in 1961. The stay was not the therapeutic experience one would endure today. It was terrifying and not helpful. After her stay, Marilyn continued to spiral and suffer through the terrifying demons that lived in her mind. But when in front of her fans and the press, she for the most part put on such a convincing show. She appeared happy. She wanted her fans to think she was happy. But in reality, she was in a deep depression. Something that could have been at least partially healed by one very simple remedy. Love. Marilyn Monroe was dead within 6 months. In her final months on Earth, Marilyn and Joe DiMaggio briefly rekindled their relationship. He was there for her when she needed him the most after her release from the psychiatric hospital. He was a good friend to her. In June of 1961, Marilyn moved into Frank Sinatra's house while her home underwent renovations. She was in with the Rat Pack. Frank, Sammy, Dean, Joey, and Peter. Peter Lawford, brother-in-law to brothers John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. Marilyn Monroe had been known to spend some time with John F. Kennedy during his campaign for presidency in the fall of 1960. By early 1962, her reported involvement with the president's brother, U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, was out. The General. On May 19, 1962, Marilyn Monroe famously sang Happy Birthday to President John F. Kennedy during his birthday celebration at Madison Square Garden. Shortly after this iconic performance, both Kennedy brothers abruptly cut ties with Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn just wanted love. She wanted respect. She wanted safety. Marilyn Monroe was found dead in the bedroom of her home on August 5, 1962. She was 36 years old.
It was the evening of August 4, 1962, in Brentwood, Los Angeles. Marilyn Monroe's home sat tucked away on 5th Helena Drive, a modest Spanish-style house, white stucco walls, and a red tilted roof, with only 4 rooms inside. It was quiet, private, and in some ways the first home she'd ever truly owned by herself. That Saturday had been filled with familiar rhythms. The housekeeper, Eunice Murray, was around the property, and Marilyn's psychiatrist, Dr. Ralph Greenson, stopped by earlier in the day. She had phone calls throughout the afternoon and into the night, reaching out to friends, colleagues, and even members of her inner circle. To some, she sounded upbeat, talking about future projects and plans for the week ahead. She told one friend she was excited about discussions with Fox and was even considering reconciliation with Joe DiMaggio, who had remained a steady presence in her life since their divorce 7 years earlier. Those who heard that version of Marilyn remembered a woman who seemed to be looking forward. But others remembered something different. On other calls, some described her voice as distracted, uneven, as if her thoughts were caught in a tug-of-war between optimism and despair. She was still struggling with insomnia, leaning heavily on prescriptions to balance her energy and sleep. To those friends, she sounded fragile, almost like she was trying to convince herself she was fine. The last call of the night came around 7:40 p.m. to actor Peter Lawford, the brother-in-law of President John F. Kennedy. Lawford later said that Marilyn's words chilled him. Her tone was flat, and what she said felt like a farewell. According to him, she told him, "Say goodbye to Pat, say goodbye to Jack. You're a nice guy." He tried to keep her on the line, pressing her to explain, but the call ended abruptly. Lawford was so shaken that he tried calling back repeatedly, but the line was either busy or went unanswered. The last strange call, somewhere between a casual goodbye and a cryptic farewell, has haunted every account of Marilyn's final night. Was it a slip, a signal of intent, or simply a conversation twisted by hindsight? What we know is that after that moment, the world's most famous actress was never heard from again. The sun went down over Brentwood, and in that quiet house on Fifth Helena Drive, Marilyn Monroe spent what would become her last hours. As midnight approached on August 4th, the small home was quiet. Eunice Murray, Marilyn's housekeeper, later said she noticed a strange detail. Marilyn's bedroom light was still on. It wasn't unusual for her to read or make calls late into the night. But the glow coming from under the door seemed constant, unbroken. When Murray tried the door, she found it locked. That, too, was unusual. Marilyn rarely locked herself in. Murray knocked, no answer. She called out Marilyn's name, still nothing. Uneasy, she phoned Dr. Ralph Greenson, Marilyn's psychiatrist, who lived nearby. Greenson arrived around midnight. Together, he and Murray tried again, calling her through the door. Silence. They finally looked through the bedroom window. The curtains were sheer enough to reveal a figure lying face down on the bed, motionless, a telephone still in her hand. Greenson forced the window open and climbed inside. Marilyn was unresponsive. Empty pill bottles were scattered on the nightstand. It was 12:30 a.m. when Dr. Greenson pronounced her dead. Yet police weren't notified until nearly 4:30 a.m. A gap of 4 unexplained hours that has never been convincingly accounted for. That delay would become one of the most contested mysteries in the case. Why wait so long to call authorities? What exactly happened between the moment Greenson found her and the moment the LAPD was finally summoned? What's clear is this. By the time officers arrived, Marilyn Monroe was already gone. What happened next has haunted the official timeline ever since. Eunice Murray later admitted she called Marilyn's physician, Dr. Hyman Engelberg, before contacting authorities. According to reports, Engelberg arrived sometime after Greenson confirmed that Marilyn was already gone and quietly signed her death certificate on the spot. Only then, hours later, did anyone call the police. So why the wait? Some say it was panic, a desperate attempt to shield Marilyn from scandal in her final moments. But others believe it was something more calculated, that those hours were spent altering the scene, removing evidence, or even moving Marilyn's body before putting her back in the room. Greenson's story shifted depending on who asked. Engelberg was vague, insisting the delay was unintentional. To this day, the gap between the discovery and the official police call remains one of the most suspicious elements of Marilyn's death. When the LAPD finally arrived at 5th Helena Drive in the early morning hours of August 5th, what they walked into was less a crime scene than a carefully staged tableau. And that, more than anything, has kept the questions alive for over 60 years. When the LAPD finally entered Marilyn's bedroom, they took stock of the scene. By her bed were several empty pill bottles, lined up almost neatly. They noted something strange almost immediately. There was no glass of water anywhere in the room. For someone who supposedly swallowed dozens of capsules, the absence of the glass became an early red flag. The autopsy was conducted by Dr. Thomas Noguchi, the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner. His findings were stark. The cause of death was listed as acute barbiturate poisoning. Toxicology revealed lethal amounts of two drugs, Nembutal, a powerful sleeping pill, and chlorohydrate, a sedative. The levels in her blood and liver were so high that either drug alone could have been fatal. Noguchi ruled her death a probable suicide. But even in the first reports, questions began to surface. No pills were found in her stomach. Unusual given the sheer quantity required to reach the toxic levels found in her system. That absence left investigators debating whether the drugs had been ingested hours earlier, dissolved too quickly to trace, or administered by another method. The accounts from the other people in the house didn't make things any clearer. Housekeeper Eunice Murray gave one version of events to police, another to reporters, and yet another years later in interviews. Dr. Greenson, too, shifted details, at times suggesting he had been called earlier, other times later. Their inconsistencies only fueled the sense that something was being concealed. Then came the rumors. Officers noted that Marilyn's body seemed to have been positioned deliberately. stretched across the bed with the phone in her hand. Later reports suggested that the bed sheets may have been changed before authorities were called. None of these claims were ever proven, but the lack of consistent timelines, coupled with the unexplained delay, left a permanent shadow over the investigation of the death of Marilyn Monroe. What should have been a straightforward overdose looked instead like a scene carefully curated, whether by panic or by design. One of the most straightforward explanations for Marilyn Monroe's death is also one of the most overlooked, the possibility of an accident. For years, Marilyn had battled chronic insomnia and relentless anxiety. Sleep rarely came without help, and doctors were all too willing to provide it. By the summer of 1962, she had prescriptions from multiple physicians, sometimes for overlapping medications. In her cabinet, barbiturates sat beside sedatives, each pill carrying the promise of rest, but also the risk of dependency. Two of the drugs she relied on the most, which I mentioned earlier, were chlorohydrate, a strong sedative, and Nembutal, a powerful barbiturate. Experts who have revisited the toxicology reports argue that the combination of the two could easily overwhelm the body if the timing between doses was too close. Supporters of this theory point to her daily routine. Marilyn often reached for one pill to fall asleep and then woke in the night and reached for another. It's possible she misjudged the spacing or simply forgot that she had already taken her dose. Without a glass of water found at her bedside, some speculate the drugs may have been taken earlier, then built up in her system through the night. To those who believe this accidental theory, Marilyn's death was not premeditated and not deliberate. It was the tragic culmination of a life caught between stardom and fragility, aided by a culture of overprescribing. She didn't plan to die that night. She may have only been trying to get some sleep. What makes this theory more compelling is the wider culture of medicine in Hollywood at the time. Doctors, sometimes called Dr. Feelgoods, were notorious for prescribing heavy sedatives, stimulants, and barbiturates without concern for long-term effects. Stars like Judy Garland and later Elvis Presley would suffer from the same cycle: pills to wake up, pills to work, pills to sleep. Marilyn's cabinets were stocked from multiple prescribers, sometimes without coordination, a practice that today would be considered medical malpractice. In that environment, an accidental overdose wasn't just possible, it was quite likely. Marilyn was navigating a system designed to medicate her into functionality, even at the cost of her safety. Her death wasn't just a personal tragedy, it was a symptom of the Hollywood machine, where pharmaceuticals replaced care. Now, the theory that Marilyn took her own life has always been the official version. The autopsy listed her death as a probable suicide, and on paper, the evidence seemed to support it. Marilyn had a long documented history of depression. She had been hospitalized multiple times for psychiatric care. There were at least two previous overdoses on pills, one in 1950 and another in 1960, both of which she survived. Friends and doctors alike knew she struggled with the pull between life and escape, between survival and surrender. The weeks before her death were especially difficult. She was still reeling from her dismissal from the film Something's Got to Give, after constant absences and clashes with 20th Century Fox. Professionally, she felt discarded. Personally, her relationships had left her feeling isolated. She was divorced 3 times and currently estranged from Arthur Miller, and rumored to be in conflict with the Kennedy brothers. For a woman who thrived on connection, the silence was crushing. Yet the testimonies of those closest to her painted 2 conflicting pictures. Some friends described a Marilyn who seemed optimistic. She spoke about her career, even planning to attend a party the next day. Others recalled a woman fraying at the edges, exhausted and afraid of being abandoned. This tension between hope and despair is what makes the suicide theory both persuasive and unsettling. There's no question that she had the means, the history, and the emotional weight that could drive someone towards such an act. That, combined with the toxicology report, was enough for officials to close the case as a suicide. But for many, the contradictions in her mood and the abruptness of her final hours left the ruling feeling less like a certainty and more like a conclusion of convenience. Of all the theories surrounding Marilyn Monroe's death, none has stirred more controversy than the idea that she was silenced. At the center of this conspiracy are her alleged affairs with President John F. Kennedy and his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. Rumors swirled that Marilyn had grown too close, that she knew too much about their private lives or even about matters of state. Some believed that she was threatening to go public, that she was becoming a liability to men whose careers could not survive scandal. The government's own files deepened the suspicion. FBI and CIA documents confirmed that Marilyn was closely monitored in the last year of her life. She was seen as a risk because of her political associations, her friendships with left-leaning intellectuals, and her intimacy with the most powerful men in the country. To conspiracy theorists, that level of surveillance suggests the government already saw her as dangerous. In the early 1960s, surveillance wasn't subtle. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI routinely opened files on public figures, not just politicians, but actors, musicians, and even authors. Anyone suspected of leftist sympathies. Phones were tapped, mail was intercepted, hotel rooms bugged. For Marilyn, the suspicion wasn't abstract. Her FBI file, now declassified, runs more than 300 pages. It includes notes of her friendships with playwright Arthur Miller and other quote-unquote suspect intellectuals. They also include reports of her attending social gatherings linked to activist circles and repeated mentions of her closeness to both Kennedy brothers. To most, this looks like routine paranoia of the Cold War era. But to those who believe foul play, it's proof that Marilyn was already under a microscope. That if something happened to her, the government either knew more than they admitted or possibly chose silence. From there, the theories widened. Some argue it wasn't the Kennedys themselves, but maybe their enemies. The mob, already entangled with both brothers over investigations into organized crime, may have seen Marilyn as leverage, or as a loose end. A woman with powerful connections, vulnerable and outspoken, could have been silenced to protect interests much larger than her own. In recent years, new details added fuel to the fire. In 2022, Netflix released The Mystery of Marilyn Monroe, The Unheard Tapes, featuring interviews that pointed to missing wiretap recordings from her home. Tapes that may have captured her final unsettling phone calls. Then, in 2024, files from private investigator Fred Otash surfaced. In them, Otash claimed that Robert Kennedy and Peter Lawford were with Marilyn during her last hours, attempting to calm her down before her condition spiraled. If that's true, it would mean that the official timeline was far from the whole story. But here's the problem. None of it, of course, is proven. The recordings vanished, the files are decades old, often secondhand, and impossible to verify. Witnesses have contradicted one another for years. The official record says suicide. The conspiracy theories insist murder. And the truth is suspended somewhere in between a story where power, politics, and paranoia collide. Another reason this theory has been held on to so tight is because of the autopsy itself. The medical examiner who performed it, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, was still fairly new to his role in 1962. Supporters of the murder theory argue that inexperience may have caused him to miss something, or worse, the outside pressure kept him from saying more. In the years that followed, rumors circulated that Noguchi had privately admitted Marilyn was murdered. Some writers have gone so far as to claim that Dr. Noguchi later confessed near the end of his life. It's an appealing story, and one that still circulates in articles and blogs today. But there is no hard evidence to back this up. What we do know is that in his own memoir, Noguchi admitted that there were irregularities in the case, missing samples, conflicting reports, and of course, unanswered questions. Enough perhaps to explain why the rumor of a deathbed confession has survived so long. While he never reversed his ruling of probable suicide, he made it clear that the case was left with enough unanswered questions to keep suspicion alive. His later career, filled with high-profile autopsies from Robert Kennedy to Sharon Tate and Natalie Wood, cemented his reputation as the coroner to the stars. And yet for many, the idea lingers that Marilyn Monroe's death was the one case even Noguchi couldn't close with certainty. Those problems don't disappear just because the confession story isn't true. The truth remains that Noguchi never reversed his ruling. Now let's look at this case through a psychological lens. To understand Marilyn's death, many turn to not only the evidence, but the woman herself. Behind the legend was a lifelong struggle with identity. As Aaron mentioned, Marilyn was born Norma Jean Mortensen, but the world came to know her as Marilyn Monroe. For years, she lived in the space between the two. A woman who craved love and family, and the other a carefully constructed image of glamour and desire. Her childhood was marked by trauma and instability. She grew up in foster homes and orphanages, rarely staying in one place for long. Her mother battled severe mental illness, and the shadow of abandonment followed Marilyn throughout her life. That fear resurfaced in nearly every relationship she had, often leaving her clinging to men who could not provide the security she so desperately needed. Her mental health struggles were well documented. Marilyn faced severe depression, underwent multiple psychiatric hospitalizations, and carried the weight of loneliness even at the height of her fame. Pills became a daily presence to sleep, to wake, to steady her moods. A cycle that created both dependency and fragility. And yet, she was not without power. On screen, Marilyn was magnetic, in control of her image in a way that few stars ever were. She knew what audiences wanted, and she delivered it with precision. But privately, that control unraveled. Friends described her as deeply vulnerable, sometimes childlike in her need for reassurance. Her death, like her life, became a projection. The official ruling of suicide fit a narrative of the tragic starlet undone by her own fragility. Others saw conspiracy, murder, a cover-up worthy of her political and cultural connections. Either way, the real woman, Norma Jean, was buried beneath layers of myth. In the end, the psychology of Marilyn Monroe's story may not lie in whether she chose her death or not, but in how the world chose to remember her. A woman who wanted to be taken seriously instead of a symbol of beauty, scandal, and mystery. Marilyn's influence didn't end with her death. In the 6 decades since, she has become the most popular and recognizable movie star in the world. She's an enduring cultural icon. Andy Warhol's portraits turned her face into pop art mythology. Musicians from Elton John to Madonna to Lana Del Rey have sung about her as both a muse and a cautionary tale. Fashion houses still invoke her image, recreating the white dress, the red lips, and the platinum hair. Every generation seems to rediscover her, reshaping her story into what they most need it to be, a symbol of desire, a warning of fame's cost, or a reminder of the fragility hidden behind the spotlight. She's been branded the ultimate sex symbol, the blueprint for female allure. Yet the truth is far more complicated. Marilyn was simply never just these things. She was not just a symbol to be obtained. She was a gifted actress, a skilled singer, and an intelligent woman who constantly fought to be taken seriously. The tragedy is not only how she died, but how little the world truly valued her while she lived, and how much more she could have given us had she been allowed to grow beyond the myth. That perhaps is the real loss. Marilyn Monroe remains an icon, but the woman behind the image was always more than what the world had chosen to see. Her death may never be fully explained, but her presence in art, culture, and in the collective imagination is undeniable. She is both Norma Jean and Marilyn, both human and myth, forever blurred. What we know is this. The evidence we have is that Marilyn's long struggle with insomnia and depression, the overlapping prescriptions, the toxic mix of Nembutal and chlorohydrate, point most clearly to an accidental overdose, the tragic endpoint of a system that medicated her fragility instead of stabilizing it. So we land here. Marilyn Monroe most likely died from a medication miscalculation, an accidental overdose made possible by polypharmacy and poor medical oversight. It's not the most sensational answer. It is the most consistent with what we actually know. What we don't know, maybe what we'll never know, is why. And until those answers come, her story and her truth still remain wanted. In the end, Marilyn Monroe's death remains unsettled. Was it a tragic accident, an intentional act, or something darker hidden behind power and silence?
Her life was defined by contradictions, vulnerability and strength, fame and loneliness, truth and myth. Even in death, she became more symbol than person.
But the woman at the center of it all was real, Norma Jean, a young girl who built herself into a star, only to find that the world she created could not protect her.
Her story is still debated. Her legacy is still felt. And the mystery of her last night still lingers.
Thank you for joining us for this special crossover episode. If you love the stories of Hollywood's brightest stars, their triumphs, and fun facts, be sure to listen to Stars of the Golden Age wherever you're listening right now.
And if you want more true crime and unsolved mysteries, make sure to follow The Wanted Files.
Until next time, stay curious, stay safe, take care of yourselves and each other.
What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hi, listeners. Grace Anna here, host of Art Muse, a podcast that shares the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art. In doing so, Art Muse aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret these well-known works by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. Each episode focuses our attention on a specific female muse, sharing their important life and legacy. By sharing these women's stories, we are given the opportunity to appreciate artworks from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Season 3 continues to share the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art, this time focusing on artist models who were also performers in their own right. Season 3 will begin its release this fall. We cannot wait to share these amazing women's stories with you. In the meantime, we hope you continue to enjoy Season 1 and 2 of Art Muse, available on all streaming platforms. Until next time, bye for now.